It is August 10th, 2018. This is Anjali Grantham, and I am here with Wayne Matta at his home in Maple Valley, Washington. Wayne, to begin with, could you tell me a bit about your childhood? Where did you grow up? When were you born? And what brought you to American Can?
I was born in Brainerd, Minnesota, 1930. And during the war in 1944, I moved out here with my folks. They came out here to work like at Boeing's or the shipyards. And so that was when I was 14 years old. So anyway, I graduated from Renton High. And then from there, I joined the Army for 4 years. Well, 3 years, but I got extended for the convenience of the government because of the Korean War. And I was stationed over in Europe, which fortunately I didn't go the other way to Korea. And so 1953, I met my wife, Carol, and we got married in 1954. And I was working in the Bremerton Naval Yards at that time and traveling from Renton to Bremerton. And it was a 12-hour day, you know, just driving to Renton, parking underneath the viaduct, taking that ferry, what's that, Kalakala? I call it the Kalakala, it's over there in Kodiak, yeah. So then I get same way coming back and never got home till 7 o'clock, so my wife's father was working at American Can. So anyway, I put my application in at Boeing's, Continental Can, and some other machine shops around town, and also an American Can Company. And fortunately, I was called by, I got a letter from Boeing, says, well, your name has been placed on top of the list, come on down. And so I wrote him a letter, says, well, I just got hired by American Can. And so that was very fortunate. My father-in-law probably had a lot of help. And then I had a brother-in-law that was working there too. So it was nice to have some relatives there. And it turned out a very, very good employment for me, and I enjoyed being a maintenance machinist. And when the plant closed down, I got into the Alaska division, and then that closed down. When the Alaska division closed down, well, then I started going up to my own to different canneries, like Kodiak Salmon Packers. Excursion Inlet was Ocean Beauty, then Trident and Ketchikan. And 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there, and 6 weeks in Ketchikan. And prior to that, when American Can closed down, I went to work for AGS. Then I worked for them for 9 years. Then I had a heart attack, so I called it quits. And that's when the other companies called me up to come on up and give them a hand. So I did. All I was a finger pointer, training the younger fellows on the operation of the fillers and cutters and the seamers. So let's see, got to think. So that I enjoyed that. Oh, no.
Could you tell me about the American Can Company shop in Seattle? How many people were employed there and what was happening there?
Well, that was, they had 9 can lines, manufactured all different types of cans, beer cans, juice cans, vegetable cans, cat food cans and stuff like that. And then they had one line there, it was strictly for the Alaska cans, which they flattened out. So they had a lot of, probably a couple hundred people working there because They even had a cafeteria up there, too, at the American Can Company. And then they had the lithographers, you know, that printed the cans. And then they had machinists, we called them machinists, down the can lines, you know, operating the lines. And then we had the maintenance machinists, which I was. And then we had millwrights and electricians. And, I'd say there was at least a couple hundred people working there, huh? And the reason why they closed it down, I think, is because it was a 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 stories high or something like that. And they're trying to reduce the cost of, you know, moving this machinery. The cans are back and forth, you know, and so then they started building canneries or can making plants on one story, and so they did away with all their old can plants, and they had machine shops in Portland, Oregon, Geneva, New York, Cincinnati, and Niagara Falls, Canada. And they built this equipment, these machine shops. And finally, they closed them down. And then American Can merged with National Can. It became known as American National Can. And then finally, American Can got out of it altogether. And American National Can, there was a National Can plant in Kent. And so then it became American National Can, and then they were bought out, and it's called Rexam. And that's where I get my pension from now, is Rexam.
R-E-X-A-M?
Yeah.
Rexam.
Right,
yeah. So, how in the Seattle can shop, what portion of production was dedicated to salmon cans?
Well, at the can manufacturing plant in Seattle, like I said, there was only one line, and it didn't operate, you know, around the year, and it only operated on the orders that they got coming in from the canneries up north. And then they just run that line and got those orders filled out and
so
close it down.
Was there a difference between a salmon can and a fruit can?
Well, let's see. Not really. The only thing would be the enamel inside. Some fruit cans and vegetable cans had to have special enamel or whatever because of the acidic, like tomatoes and stuff like that. But otherwise, they were the same enameled cans. But there was some that was lithographed, you know, had pictures of like a Hawaiian, I forget that, Hawaiian punch. Mm-hmm. That was a beautiful can with all those fruit, you know, around it, stuff like that.
So could you tell me, what did your job entail when you were still working for Seattle Can in the can-making shop?
Oh, my shop, American Can, my job at American Can was a maintenance machinist. And, we had periods of periods that we had to, you know, there was a breakdown. We had to get down there and get that, like a chain broke or something like that. We'd have to get down there and repair it, put a new chain on, and then we'd have a line that had to be overhauled, and then we'd have to go through that. But my job was a maintenance machinist, and it's kind of different from other machinists. Because some other machinists in these other places, they just stand at a machine all day long, a lathe. But we were able to, you know, work around, and then when there's no breakdowns or no overhauls, well, I maintained what they call a roller station and also the flex spot, because as you're, they put these things like this, the cans, you know, they're all cut out, you know, and you put those in the stack, and then they go down the line, and then they go into this what I just mentioned.
Roll.
Yeah, the roller station, and it'd roll the can so it'd go like that. Mm-hmm. And then it would go to another machine, and it would put a hook on each side of the can and flatten it out, and then it'd go through a flux pot. And the flux pot was solder, liquid solder. And then it'd go on.
So flux, F-L-U-X?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Flux. And then it'd go on and go through what they call a solder bath. And it's a big bath like that. And they had a roller and a pickup. And then the cans would go like that. And that's where you get your soldered side seam. Mm-hmm. And then after that, well, there's the brushes to get the excess solder off. Mm-hmm. So that was the making of the can.
So I know that before, many canneries, before the sanitary can, would make all their own cans on site. Did you ever come across some of this old machinery at canneries in Alaska where they, before the sanitary can came around?
No, the only place that I know of was Alaska. No, I guess it was Alaska Packers at that time, which is Kodiak Salmon Packers, or Icicle now. They had Chinese laborers there doing that, making the cans. But I was there once, and I come across a solder roll. I couldn't believe, what's this solder roll doing here in Kodiak or Larsen Bay? Still baffled by that. Nobody knew it. But this was, like I said, this was a solder bath that we had, this roller.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only... I guess they had the Chinese somewhere else, I think around Uganic Bay or somewhere around there, too. And but going back to Larsen Bay there, the cannery... They got a place called Frenchie's Point, and that's where the Chinese were buried. And then they had another cemetery for the white people, and then another cemetery for the people that lived in Larsen Bay there, the natives. So,
I'm wondering, I was thinking about how the can shop over time was essentially removed, right, after the reformer was no longer needed. I'm wondering if at a place like Larsen Bay, where within the warehouse or within the cannery proper they would have been making the cans, I wonder if that would have been in the can shop, or do you have any sense?
I have no idea, because there's, Larsen Bay there, they had Chinese bunkhouse. Yeah, just... they used to, they had these little bottles, you know, what was it, they'd drink, you know, and throw them away. It was some drug, anyway. And, so, let's see. Oh, yeah, here. So these were from Larsen Bay.
I see these little vials.
Yeah, vials. They break the top off. Mm. I forget what the note says.
Antique found by Wayne Matta Sr. in the ground around the old Chinese bunkhouse at Larsen Bay, Alaska, found in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I forget what they had in those bottles.
I think it's rumored opium.
Opium. That's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Opium. That's it. That's it. Yeah, I never did find a full bottle. Yeah.
So then, back to the can manufacturing line at American Can in Seattle. That I'm curious about the different sides of the operation, because clearly they had the can plant where they're making the cans, but then what about the place where they were making the machines?
Oh, the American can machines?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like you say, the American can machines were made in these, like in the Portland machine shop, mm-hmm. and also Geneva, New York, and Cincinnati, and then they had the machine shop, up in Niagara, Canada. But then after a while, these machine shops made spare parts, you know, and like the chucks on the seamers and stuff like that. And then these fillers and cutters were made in the early 30s. So they're still using them. Like, it's unbelievable. And American Can had most of the packing lines, machining, owned them. And that's when they had a monopoly. You know, you buy our cans, you know, you got our equipment. And they had this judgment, I think it was in San Francisco judgment in 1948, that said American had to sell their packing lines to the customers if they wanted to, and then they could get the buying cans from Continental Can or whoever.
Mm-hmm. Because before, the canneries would lease the machinery from American Can, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so then it was, the change was that then you'd service them? Or what was the relationship after that,
we actually didn't service that equipment. But we, as servicemen, if the customer asked us to work on the equipment, we had to charge them what they called D time, you know, and we had so much an hour. And if we worked on there for 5 hours, they were charged, I forget how much, but then after a while, that didn't go very well with the customer, so America Can just cut it out, says, well, they want your help, help them. Mm-hmm.
How did you transition from working in the can manufacturing to servicing the equipment?
Well, you're a maintenance machinist, you know, and you can overhaul just about any equipment, you mm-hmm. know, and stuff like that. So they had, some of the equipment came down to American Can to be overhauled, but I wasn't in that part. And they had other fellows previous, and they, when the American Can closed down, and they left, and that's why I got into the Alaska business, because of these fellows leaving. So anyway, you know, a piece of machinery is a piece of machinery, yeah, and that's it.
Mm. Could you talk about the early years when American Can used to travel up? You mentioned they would go in a special ship.
Yeah, we're right. The American Can had their own ship. And they would be loaded with these wooden boxes, you know, 48 cans to a box. And then the servicemen at that time would jump on board and sail up to Ketchikan, and while they're unloading the cans, well, they'd go into the cannery and do their part as far as getting the equipment back to pre-season, because when you put it away for the winter, there's a lot of grease on the horns to keep them from rusting, and they got to clean that all up, and they got to start they had line shafting too, you know, and nowadays they're all motorized. That was one of the things. But yeah, when they'd hop back on the board and catch a can, they'd probably go on up to Chatham Strait there, the New England Fish and places like that. And they'd turn around and come back with the ship.
Mm-hmm.
But Yeah, there was some Joe Dzaki was one of the names, and Vern Taylor, and some of the older guys I never ever knew because they had disappeared or left the camp before I did. But these fellows were telling. Joe Dzaki, he's the one that had the Chris Craft up in Cordova.
So what machines did American Can Company make that were used by the salmon canneries?
Oh, it was a filler. Oh, the cutter first, then the filler, the weighing machine, that, you know, weighed, and the patching table, and the curler clincher, and a seamers, 300 back.
What about the reformer? Was that?
Well, the reformers were owned by American Can. And we maintained them.
What was the cutter?
The cutter would, they had, the cutter was like that. And they had a table here with these rakes going up like that. And they had a fellow on this side and a fellow on that side. And they placed the salmon. Well, of course they had the iron chinks, you know, first that the salmon had to go cut the heads, take the guts out and stuff like that, and the fins and stuff like that. Then they'd lay the salmon there, and then these rakes would put them up, and then they would go into the cutter, and they were big knives, about 15 inches in diameter, and they were spaced, you know, depending upon whether it was a half pound or a 1 pound. And that's what the cutter would do. Then he had a bucket chain and move it along. And then they would go into a line there, and then they had the filler. And the filler had a rotary in it, and cans would come in one way, and the fish would come in through a tunnel. And then he had pusher forks that would push the stakes into the filler. They had plungers, and they'd go up, and then they'd push the stakes into the can, and then they'd go around. And then, they cross the weighing machine, they weigh them. They had a two-lane patching table, and if the lightweights would go out one way, and the heavies or whatever, the right-on weight would just go like that. But then he had women on both sides, women and men, and if there was any bone sticking up, you know, they'd trim it, or any skin showing, they'd have to tuck it, because they didn't want the housewife to see the skin. And from there, they would go to the clincher, and the clincher would put an end on it, and slightly clinch the end over the flange of the can. And then from there, they would go to a can wash, and then wash any salmon or things on the outside of the can. Then they go into the 300 back, and they had, three heads, they would call seaming heads. And then they had the first operation that would tighten the clinch a little bit, and then the 300 back would suck the air out, and then the final seam would be to seam the can, right? And then they would go, before they used to have what they called cooling trays, but now they have what they call bussy baskets, or, you know, 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet high, and then they'd pack, I don't know, maybe 1,500 cans into the bussy baskets. And that saved on dents, because these trays, boy, you get dented cans all over. But anyway, from there they'd go into what they call a retort. And the retort is nothing but a pressure cooker. And they'd cook the tall cans for so many minutes and a half pound for so many minutes and stuff like that. And then they go up in the case up. And they have to go in a big warehouse, and you can hear the cans cooling out, going pop, 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 stuff like that. But they also try to use four-pound cans. Mm. And the four-pound cans are a good size, 4 pounds of salmon. And they would go to institutions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And quarter-pound cans, half-pound cans, 1 pound. Well, they're not 1 pound cans anymore. Mm-hmm. They always, mm-hmm. 14 ounces now. So then they'd, once they're cooled off, they would go into a case up. And nowadays they, I don't know how many cans they put, but then they shrink wrap it and mm-hmm. on a pallet and out the door they go. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So when did you start servicing the canneries in Alaska? What year was that?
Let's see. Trying to think of the can plant, probably closed down about 68, somewhere around there, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I, the total time, I think of me being up in Alaska, probably had 30 years, you know, full summers and partial summers, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And what would you commonly do when you would go to a cannery in Alaska? What were common problems or fixes that you would make?
There wasn't any fixes. It was just all pre-season work, you know. Mm-hmm. And then of course, when it comes down to the seamer, we had to check the seams, you know. And there's we had a seam mic and stuff like that. He had to check the body hook and the counter hook, the tightness, and just to make that there was no droops, and we had to make sure that seam was perfect. Mm-hmm. Right. So.
How would you do that?
How
would you make a perfect seam?
So, Lee, you've got all these dimensions that you have to go by. Mm-hmm. The body hook is, say, got to be so many. You cover hook, you have to tear the end off. You tear the end off, and then you start miking.
Mm-hmm. Like with a microscope?
They call it a seam mic. Mm. I got one out in the shop, but it's like a micrometer, let's see. Yeah. And you gotta make sure the body hook is so and so, the cover hook is so and so, and then you gotta check the tightness. You gotta look, and there's a little wave or too much of a wave, that means that you gotta tighten up your seam. So anyway, I did that. That's probably. And now they got machines that check for, I mean, you still got to do your checks, but they got these machines that'll check for a droop when you're in an operation. And the droop is caused by a bone in the seam or a piece of skin in the seam and stuff like that. Mm. And then it kicks it out. And they got to open the can and recan it. Mm.
So you'd get the seamer ready on the typical cannery visit.
What?
On the typical cannery visit.
Yeah, right. They do that every couple of hours. They've got to check the seams. Mm-hmm. Mm. Right. They got to make everything dog got in the shop there. You've probably seen a chart.
of the cannery?
Yeah, yeah. Put down everything.
Mm,
all okay. Your measurements down. Uh-huh. All your measurements down.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed going cannery to cannery, especially when I was on my own.
So would you always, even when you were working for American Can, you would travel to these different canneries alone, or would you bring an assistant?
No, I spent, I don't know how many years in Cordoba, just by myself. Well, when I first went up, I went with somebody, you know, to bring me in and stuff like that. And then the second year, I went up on my own, Cordoba, I was there for 8 years. Kodiak Island, I think I was there for flying around Kodiak, 6 years, and then I was in the bay for 1 or 2 years up there.
And who were the other servicemen that you worked with?
Well, it was Wendell Weirich. There was Naslund. I can't think of his name now. Naslund, and Harold French. And the name is just didn't come to me right. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But like Harold French, he's passed away, and name I can't come up with it. Yeah, so there's two of them that passed away. There's still three of us out of the five.
Mm.
Oh, Dick Naslund was the name. McBride, yeah. He's passed away. He's a young guy, too. He's just a young guy, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Ronald McBride. There we go. Mm. I've got it.
So what were the machines that Continental Can would make versus American Can? And how was that a fierce competition, or how did that work out?
Yeah, well, like the can shops there, mostly it was American Can, but the can shops at Continental Can, their can shop reforming the cans were, I'd say, much more superior than American Can. But as far as the packing lines go, it was strictly American Can.
Mm-hmm.
There's very few canneries that even have a Continental Can seamer. I don't know, let's see. I don't know if Yaganic. I was thinking Yaganic Bay might have. Right.
Yes, because I met with Harvey Henry yesterday, and he worked on a Continental Can seamer in Yaganic.
Oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe not too bad.
Good.
Yeah.
So what sort of innovations were there over the years? Did the machines just stay the same, or what changes were there?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think of them. They're basically the same, the American Can filler cutters but they don't have weighing machines anymore because they have
the digital scales?
Yeah, I guess that's what you call it. So.
Mm.
Digital scale there. And so that did away with the Continental weighing machine and American weighing machine. But the Continental weighing machine was better than the American can.
Mm.
I'm trying to think of any improvements that they made in the cutter. Well, somebody tried to, I think it was Lars Eknes, tried to make a 3/4-pound cutter and filler. And I think they do have one at Larson Bay. Instead of making aluminum buckets, they had plastic buckets and stuff like that. So I think that's the only line that they have that... the 3/4-pound line.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them are, well, There are quarter pound lines at AGS and Trident. And then I don't know if Trident even puts up a 4 pound anymore. But as far as improving machines, like the American Ken cutters, they're basically what they were in the past. And the same way with the cutter. Well, years ago, yeah, see, American Ken had a filler and a cutter, and it was a chop knife. And fish would come in there and this chop knife, like a guillotine. And they would, of course, those machines have been turned over, and now they have what they call a rotary knife that cuts the fish at going in the tunnel. They go in the tunnel, and the tunnel will only take so much, and then they gotta cut it off. And then the next load goes through.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a guillotine. Yeah. Chop knife.
Of the typical machines within a salmon cannery, are they similar or different from like a fruit cannery?
Oh, let's see. I've never been into a fruit cannery. Mm. Oh, they would
or
be
some other sort of cannery.
Oh, yeah, they would be different, entirely different. Yeah, right. But yeah, they wouldn't have a salmon cannery cutter or filler or anything like that. No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the machines were specially designed to accommodate salmon.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish I would have gone through a cannery. Yeah, that'd be nice.
And in your view, having been to all sorts of canneries, what made a good cannery?
The chow. The chow. That's all. Yeah. Yeah. Boy, some of the canneries, well, years ago, they really, really put out the food. And they had, you know, a Filipino mess hall. And they also had, you know, the other mess hall. And sometimes, like at Chugach up there, and Eugenic Bay, they had two mess halls there. Sometimes I'd go, you know, to they call them Filipino bunkhouses. I mean, Filipino mess halls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's, and I think the one there in Larsen Bay, I can't think of what that was. You go down Larsen Bay, and the cannery was on the right-hand side, and boy, they had the best baker. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. The best pies and you name it.
Would there be, in all the canneries that you visited, a separate mechanic mess hall or room for eating, or just some canneries?
Yeah, right. Years ago, like in the shoes in the way, sorry about that, they would have what they call a blue room, and that would be for the superintendent, the foreman, and the cannery workers. And they had those at Eacock and, any Ward's Cove cannery. Mm-hmm. And then they finally did away with the blue rooms. And Alitac, as far as I know, they're about the last ones. Well, no, they still had the blue room, right, because when I went there, well, I always ate in the blue room. And then like, I think what other? There's another cannery that had a blue room. They still kept it.
Naknek. South Naknek did.
Well, probably South Naknek and Eacock. That was a place. I think they still have those blue rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Chugach. Yeah, they had a blue room. Mm-hmm. Why they call it blue, maybe they painted the interior blue. I think that's what it was. Yeah. So, probably the best blue room food I ever had was down at Alitac when Johnny Jorgensen was there. Mm. Yeah, he always put on a good spread. And some of these canneries, like on Fridays or something like that, they get a can of beer, right? For the workers, just one can, stuff like that. If you didn't, you got a choice of your pop or something like that. But Johnny Jorgensen, boy, he always had his wine in the blue room.
Did you notice, or was it strange to you that there was segregated mess halls and segregated bunk halls?
What? No, I just, was part of the cannery industry, and I just, didn't think, at that time why they have segregated mess halls. Mm-hmm. But, I guess it'd be easier that way because the Filipinos like Filipino food and, the other people like their food, so. Mm-hmm. And it probably, they had Filipino cook, and then he had the other cook too. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So I could see why they had separate mess halls. Mm-hmm. And, right. Because that would be too much for a cook in like a Chugach to make Filipino food and serve it all, all in the same mess hall.
Mm-hmm. Were you a member of a union?
Yeah, I was a member of a local 79 here in Seattle.
Is that the same union that the machinists at the canneries belong to as well?
Yes, mm-hmm. Local 79. Mm. So American Can, worked for American Can, we were in local 79. But I worked for American Can. We had a national contract. And so we were always going for wages. And then when they closed down, I went to work, for the union up north. And for 9 years. And those 9 years, I got more retirement pay than I did for the 30 years that I worked for American Can. Mm-hmm. I was local 79 out of Seattle. Mm. And there was another local up in Everett, too, that I forget what number that was, but they had, machinists up there that went to Alaska.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember of South Naknek?
Well, South Naknek, I went to Bumblebee there at South Naknek, and they had a nice little white cottage that a serviceman stayed at. It was a nice place. And that was at Bumblebee. That was right on the point. And then further on down was Igigik. No, Igigik? Yeah. And always flying into there with not Ben Air, but what was that pilot's name? But anyway, they had a cliff there. And you could see the caskets coming out of that cliff, sticking out of that cliff because it was eroding and stuff like that. So that really caught my attention all the time. But I never really cared for that cannery. One cannery I never went to was Queens. That was owned by Bendixson, and he never bought American Can. I don't think he liked American Can at all. And he owned canneries down in here in Washington. Mm-hmm. And so he was looking. He had an American Can. What machine did he have? trying to think of a, but he needed a part for that American can machinery. The credit clincher, that's what it was. So I was down at Iggy Gig, and he had the pilot come down there and pick me up, and I was about through, I was through doing my service work there anyway. So he flies up to North Naknek, and the pilot says to Bennick, says, well, here's the American can serviceman. And old Bennick says, I don't want the American can serviceman, I want the American can part. Just like that. So anyway, I said, well, I'll go look for some. So I went down to Red Salmon and talked to Elroy, the foreman. He found the part. But he says, well, I'll have to get the okay from Brindle. And so he went and found out who wanted the part. No way. No way would he release that part. So then I went to, oh, Gary Johnson, where Gary Johnson was, and John Johnson. Oh, yeah, they had the part. They gave it to me and brought it back. And that was it. And I just told Gary, and well, you're going to have to get this all straightened out with Bendixson. And I told Bendixson the same thing. You're going to have to work it out with them and not me.
Bendixson?
Yeah, Bendixson. Mm. Yeah. And so anyway, I was kind of mad at Bendixson because he told his pilot, and I know, real, real mad. I didn't want the American can serviceman, so I had him fly me back down to Egypt. And I was all through there anyway. I was just trying to get even with Bendixson. Yeah. So anyway, everything worked out okay.
So having spent time at all these different canneries, what did you note as being differences in the operations from company to company? Did they all operate pretty much the same, or were there kind of different things depending on the company?
No, I think they all operated the same. There's I can think of, there's no, they all operated the same, all except for Klock. They wouldn't start canning until 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock or something like that, because especially on paydays, all the canning workers were from Klock in that area, and they'd go to Ketchikan and get drunk and come back, and they had to sleep it off, and they couldn't get to the cannery until 10, 11 o'clock. Yeah, otherwise, starting time was, you know, 8 o'clock somewhere on there. But that's the only cannery that I could see that was different from the other canneries. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of those canneries are closed now, and I had a list of about 32 canneries. You've probably seen that list of canneries, you know. Yeah, each one had a number. And AGS, I know that, is 62. And you take a load, a code on the top of the can, the first two numbers is the number of the cannery. So if you found something in the cannery, you know which cannery to get in contact and stuff like that. Because there's a lady down in Australia that found a piece of a small piece of brass. And so she sent it back to AGS, and it came from the cannery, because that's 62, from the Ketchikan cannery. And so they showed me that piece, and I said, oh, I know exactly where it came from. It came from the filler. And they have these blocks that close in, and sometimes they get broken off, and then they raise it back up to the, and sure enough, it wasn't even braised up. That piece just fit in there perfectly. Yeah. So Let's see.
Yeah. Could you talk about the changes that happened, or the investigations and everything that happened around the botulism outbreak?
Oh, well, let's see. I don't know. Like the changes on the reformers for American Can, that's the cause of they have buyers that come in all the time, you know, buyers from Bumblebee, even veterinarians from the Army, and because the Army buys salmon, probably those 4-pound cans or whatever. But Safeway has buyers. What's this place in England? I forget what the fellow's name is. John West. And boy, they would do a super job of going through the canneries and all the seam reports and all talk with the quality control and stuff like that. They had their spots where they could find, you know, or clean up, messed up, you know. They're pretty sharp at that. Mm-hmm. Especially at 300 back down below, they couldn't get a piece of salmon out. Well, and they also check the equipment too, like on the cutters, they had these aluminum hold down things like that. And they would inspect the machinery themselves, you know, and say, hey, this is broken, you know, whatever happened to that part, and stuff like that. And you can't re-weld a broken part onto one of these hold downs. They won't allow it. They wouldn't allow it. So they will find a fork that's been re-welded. You got to remove that, put a new one in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're sharp. Yeah.
So the reformer, what happened in the 80s with that botulism outbreak? Wasn't it a reformer problem?
It was a reformer problem, no doubt about it. Like I said, the picker fingers, they were pretty sharp. And they'd push that can out. And somehow the can was going through, and it got probably jammed up here somewhere. And that's when the picker finger poked that hole into the flange. And then, of course, it was covered up. Nobody noticed it. And then the label, you know, covered it and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And what did what did you do to change the reformers to avoid that problem?
Well, they put took the picker fingers off altogether, and they put a cam in there. It was an irregular cam, you know, and somehow then that pushed the can out onto the horns without the fear of getting it a hole in it or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, that's one thing American Can had to do, because they're not going to have these picker fingers in all these canneries anymore.
Mm-hmm. How soon after were the reformers and the can shop just kind of shut down?
Well, they started shutting down, right after, Western Can came out with the stacked cans, right? And then American Can started building these cans and Continental Can, or what they call Crown Cork and Seal now. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, then they come up with they put them in tubes, and then they have to empty the tubes, and then they put them in a stack, and then denester, and they would denest them one by one. And
what was the benefit of the stackable can versus the sanitary flat can?
Well, the benefit of it is you only had a body and a top. You didn't have that third piece, you know, on it. So that was a benefit there. And I did away with the three-piece can. It became a two-piece can. And instead of having to worry about the seams on both ends of the can, you just got one end to take care of.
Mm-hmm. So it actually was more sanitary. Did that change a lot of the operation in the cannery?
Oh, well, they had to, on packing lines, they had to adjust because these, they were tapered cans. And so the, like the filler, the things that would move the cans into the, they'd have to build them up. We had to put copper strips in about that high and bend them and then screw them in to make, adjust for the area that was, had, well, because the, what do you call it, well, that took the place of the round can, and that was a filler piece because of the tapered can. There was a filler piece there. And they had to do that on, mainly on a filler. And where else would it be? I think, well, on a curly clincher, and also on a 300 vac. They had put these. So, yeah, that was quite a work, too, for a serviceman to get up there and do all that and all the canneries.
Since then, was that the last major change on the canning line, or has there been other changes since then that you've had to accommodate?
No, that's the last major change that we had to make. Other than the canneries themselves, like I say, they call the trays, you know, they got rid of the trays and the bussy system. That was all up to the canneries. And
how did things change when canneries started to really incorporate freezing into their operations?
Well, it took away a lot of the canning that we did in the past, you know, because before those, even pinks, you know, they freeze those. Well, that was all canned and all canned. And same way with... like up in Cordova, I used to go up in Cordova for the Copper River salmon, and that was all canned. And so now all reds are frozen, and very little goes into the cans. It would be, you know, they'd be graded, you know, if they're graded in number three or they got bruised on or something like that. Then they'd put them in the cans. But you don't see very many canned reds on the market.
Were there changes within when freezing started to take over more from canning? How did the canneries adjust the layout to accommodate freezing?
Well, most of these canneries were pretty huge, you know. And I was trying to think of like Excursion Inlet there. Well, that was a different, it didn't have anything to do with the cannery. It was a different building. Trident, oh, let's see. I can't think of it, but they didn't take up much space, you know, because they put the salmon in the side, and walk the exit real short and fast trees and stuff like that. So they didn't take up much space. They didn't take up any space that the cannery had to use.
When was it that American Can shut down the Alaska Service Division?
Oh, well, let's see. I would work in 1956 for American Can, 56, 66, the 70s, I guess, early 70s, I think. Say I worked for up there in Alaska. No, probably less than that. Yeah. 56. Tony, can't come. Can't think of the year, you know, at all.
But sometime in the 70s, you think, is when they shut down the Alaska service division?
No. It had to be 70s. 56. I went to work for American Can in 56. I forget how many. We'll say 56. It had 26. It must have been in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's when you started to
go on my own. Yeah. All right.
And so then what happened? Would they send you machines or they send you to the machines?
Oh, no. They'd ship the fillers and cutters down here, or the 300 back. They'd ship them down here on, you know, containers. And they'd ship them, like AGS would ship them to Redmond. And then Redmond would, Redmond, where AGS's shop, a place is, not Redmond, on the north end of Lake Washington.
Like Kirkland?
Kirkland. Kirkland. And then they would truck the equipment over here to the shop. Yeah, then they had, AGS has another shop up in north to Ferndale, and that's where the equipment from NACNIC would go to be overhauled.
Well, looking back on your career as a machinist on the canning line and for American Can, what stands out as being important moments or important transformations over the years?
Well, instead of being able to go downstairs, I mean, down to the packing lines and be able to use my knowledge to fix that equipment on a breakdown, you know, right? It was really good. And one thing I always did too, which I go to the canneries, and I'd take everybody's name down that I would meet, you know, and I'd have these little pocketbooks. And so when I went there next year, I'd go through these, down the list of names, and hey, hi, Doug, or whatever. And it's real nice. A person likes to hear their name. And I felt real good about that. And being able to go in, cheating, of course. I felt good about that. Training. I enjoyed training these people there at Trident and other places. I really enjoyed that. That way I didn't have to climb underneath the machines or anything. I got a good pointer finger.
Are you, do you feel confident about the future of canning, or how do you feel about it?
Well, I think it'll go on. There's a lot of fish that has to be canned, you know, stuff like that. I don't know what they're going to do with that fish, you know, like grade 3 or grade 2 or whatever. They got to put them somewhere. And then, unless they grind them up for cat food. I think there'll be years to come. They got a lot of money invested, you know, in these canneries. And everybody likes to have a can of salmon now and then. Especially the Australia, the English, and they're, like you say, they're the big buyers, England and Australia and places like that. And I like to open up a can of salmon.
Me too.
And one thing, way up there at AGS, or I think other canners do the same, they always give a case of Reds to the machinist crew and office workers, naturally. And so, fortunately, I still get a case of salmon from AGS, and I also get a case of salmon from Trident. Mm-hmm. And so that's nice, but a lot of cans of salmon, you know, that's 96 cans of salmon to give away. Yeah. Because I sure can.
Because they're the half-pound cans.
Yeah, they're okay. Half-pound cans. Or, no, last time I got some quarter-pound cans from Trident.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Also, you're popular with your family.
Yeah, my relatives. Yeah, right. Relatives.
So how did you train your son? Did he just start working with you in the shop, or how did that work?
Oh, he's a natural, I guess. What you call him? No, I didn't train him at all. He worked. He went to work up there for Chugach as an electrician, and then he went to work in Kluwak there when Chugach closed down, and he just he's a better machinist than I turned out to be, and he's an electrician, he's a welder, he's a boiler man, he fires up the boilers there in Ketchikan, you know, for the steam and stuff like that. So he's an all around guy.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah. Was there anything else that you want to share, Wayne?
Well, let's see. Well, I enjoyed talking to you. Well, real nice, and doing this interview, I hope I got what you wanted.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
But we can walk out in the shop there, and I'll show you
great
some of the things.
Yeah, I'd like that.